This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. Today we begin a five-part series taking a look at some of the world's great sacred texts. Not all of them, not necessarily the best of them, though the five taken together are read by most of humanity and have been durable sources of inspiration, comfort, and statecraft for thousands of years. Starting today and finishing next month, we'll devote this hour of the program each Tuesday to a single text. Today, it's one of the best-known books in the Hindu Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita. Next, we'll learn more about the sayings of the Buddha, or the Dhammapada, then the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, sometimes called the Five Books of Moses, the four Gospels of the Christian New Testament, and in our final week in January, the Quran. During this series, we'll talk about what these books mean to believers, their impact on societies around the world, and their contributions to world literature. Across the weeks, we'll talk about where these books differ and concur with each other, and what they tell us about the worldview of the people who read and revere them. Reading the Bhagavad Gita has been a new experience for me, a lengthy dialogue between Arjuna, a warrior king, and Krishna, an incarnation of Vishnu, a principal deity of the Hindus. The two discuss the nature of life and death, valor and bravery, creation and the soul. Obviously, I speak no Sanskrit, but the translation I read was very beautiful. We'll hear some of the verses from the book in Sanskrit and English later in the program. We wanted to start by rooting the Bhagavad Gita firmly in the soil of India, the largest Hindu nation. I spoke with Ashish Nandi of the Center for the Study of Developing Societies in New Delhi about the role the Song of God plays in the life of this giant nation.
It is not Gita as a clue to war and statecraft that really moves average Indians, though it does move some Indian policymakers and perhaps thinkers. The average Indian is more moved by what Gita has to tell about how to adapt to the modern world and what kind of norms could be relevant to different political and social situations.
I've read in recent months about tremendous political power on the part of self-consciously Hindu politicians and political parties. Is this just a label that they embrace, or are they very much trying to incorporate the values found in a text like the Bhagavad Gita and in the faith of Hinduism into their public policies and their public actions?
The self-confessed Hindu parties are basically not Hindus, but they give their allegiance to something what they call Hindutva, Hinduness. That is a more political concept and has very little to do with Hindu religion, way of life, and philosophy.
How would that differ from the thought and the public utterances and writings of one of the few Hindu political thinkers known to people in the West, Mohandas Gandhi?
Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi would have rejected wholesale the present Hindu nationalist ideology which powers the various ultra-Hindu parties. Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi was basically an orthodox Hindu, as he called himself, but many others might like to call him an authentic Hindu, who was deeply rooted in the culture of his society. That Hinduism is in some fundamental sense ecumenical, as he himself once said, that he was a Hindu, a Muslim, a Christian, and a Jew, and a Sikh, and he was proud to be so, and that he felt that every other Indian was so.
And let's return just briefly to the Bhagavad Gita. Is this something that is still popularly, widely read, that even unschooled persons can cite quotations or passages from as you travel across India?
Yes. Gita is very widely read. It is very widely respected. Virtually every Indian thinker, political leader and social reformer you will find have produced his own version, his own commentary on the Gita. And these commentaries differ diametrically. Some see in Gita a justification of violence, Some say in Gita a total justification of pacifism. Some see in Gita a justification for ruthless, cynical statecraft. Some see in Gita the justification for a moral politics.
And I guess that it's just that wrestling match that we're watching played out in contemporary India.
You are absolutely right. That is the kind of contest which is going on in India. Gita is one of the texts which is crucial to that battle. And fortunately, Hinduism has more than one canonical text. It does not have a single absolute authority in the form of a text. It neither has a Quran nor has a Bible. And Gita is one of the sacred texts of Hindus, and even Gita has numerous interpretations. That plurality of interpretations, that multiplicity of uses to which sacred texts are put, is a reason for hope.
Ashish Nandi spoke to us from New Delhi, where he's a senior fellow and director at the Center for the Study of Developing Societies. If you're just joining us, we're beginning a five-part series on great sacred texts. We're beginning with the Bhagavad Gita, one of the most renowned books in the great Indian epic, the Mahabharata, which is now almost 2,000 years old. Professor Vasudha Narayanan joins us from Florida, Gainesville. She's a Gibson professor in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Florida. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here today.
And Howard Resnick is a professor of Indian Studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. And welcome to you as well, Professor Resnick.
Nice to be here, Ray.
Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. I think it's fair to say that most Americans aren't really clear on what Hinduism is as a faith. Its nature, its history, its creation story, pretty basic things. So I think it's also safe to say that we're going to have to keep this conversation sort of as an introductory primer. What should people know about Hindu scripture and where the Bhagavad Gita fits in the wide range of it? Professor Narayanan?
I think that they should realize that the Hindu tradition or traditions, has many scriptures. I speak of Hindu traditions because there is no single tradition as identifiable to a founder or a single text. And it's evolved over many centuries and lacks the kind of cohesiveness, I would say, that some of the other traditions have. Technically, and this is an elitist version, many people do believe that the Vedas are the most important texts. Western scholars give this a date of 1500 BCE. Most Hindus believe that the dates of the Vedas go much earlier. The Bhagavad Gita, on the other hand, has been a text that has been beloved of the Hindu people for more than 2,000 years. Again, this is a Western dating. Hindus prefer a much, much earlier dating for the Bhagavad Gita. But over 2,000 years, this text has been celebrated by Hindus. They learn it by heart, they comment upon it, and so on. However, I should reiterate that this book is in Sanskrit, and therefore has been privileged more than many of the vernacular texts, the vernacular works, some of the works written by women, saints over the centuries, and so on. And in the last two centuries, I may add that Orientalists and Western thinkers have also given the Bhagavad Gita a lot of importance. This is reinforced by Hindus themselves, but by the elitist Hindus, Hindus in northern India. I think the situation in southern India is slightly different because people down there go in for Tamil, Telugu, many of the vernacular works, works which treat Krishna, that's their version of the Supreme God, in a more intimate manner.
And so the pictures that one might see in books circulating in the United States of many different aspects of the deity are personalities of a great high deity, a single great high deity, or separate beings?
I think some of our texts, like the Upanishads, books written around 600 BC, philosophical texts, present the supreme deity as indescribable. ineffable, beyond human conceptualizing. And later texts like the Bhagavad Gita, which project monotheism, see this supreme God, who is beyond gender, beyond conceptualizing, as taking a human form and coming down to earth as Rama, as Krishna, as taking many incarnations. So the Bhagavad Gita tries to reconcile a polytheistic universe, which is actually the universe of practice for many Hindus, with the monotheistic rationale in the textual, in the text itself.
Professor Resnick, there is long scriptural tradition in the West of using sacred texts as a guide to doctrine, and learned people will argue points of the law and points of faith using the text as a basis for doing that. If we were to get on a plane and fly to India today, are there people doing the same thing using the Bhagavad Gita as a text, as a doctrinal source? Professor Resnick? Oh, we must have lost Professor Resnick. Well, let me turn that same question to you then, Professor Narayanan.
Well, yes and no. It depends on whom you talk to and where you are. In many parts of northern India, you do find that the Bhagavad Gita is learned by heart by people, and they are able to quote it, and they have used it for philosophical commentary, for discussions, for ethical guidance, and so on. However, it's not a book that you would find, like, say, the Gideon's Bible in a hotel room. So you don't have an equivalent of the Bible or the Quran, as Dr. Nandi pointed out earlier. But it has been used for canonical law by Brahmin commentators, male commentators. But those points of law have not been disseminated into practice over the many centuries. So yes, it's been used for textual discussions and for points of law. Almost every philosopher felt compelled to write a commentary on it, starting in the 8th century CE. And this line of commentaries has continued till today, the later ones being in English. But whether it actually translates into action is a different question. Gandhi saw a close relationship between the text and practice. So did a very famous Indian freedom fighter in the 19th century, Bal Gangadhar Tilak. But that's not the usual case with a common human being.
Ah, Professor Resnick is back. Why don't we turn the conversation at this point to this as a work of literature? It's quite beautiful poetry in addition to offering religious guidance. Professor?
Right. Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Could I just touch upon a few points that were brought up before?
Sure. I wasn't sure what you could hear and what you couldn't hear. Go ahead.
I've heard the whole program so far.
Okay.
If I could just, I don't want to avoid your question, but if I could bring up just a few points. The first quotation the first statement we heard from Ashish Nandi, I think it's important to keep in mind that he's from the Center for the Study of Developing Societies, which generally tends to be a liberal-type organization, and there's a conflict in India. You asked him a question about Hindu political parties. I don't want to get into that, but I just think the hearers should keep in mind that we heard one, I think, very partisan assessment of those issues. Apart from that, I'd also like to say that I think Dr. Narayan mentioned about a polytheistic universe. It's important to keep in mind that the Gita is ultimately a transcendental work. I mean, if you look at the conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, in the very beginning of the Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna that the Vedas, which Vasudha referred to, mainly deal with this world, how to get along in this world, laws in this world, and how to be happy in this world, how to achieve one's desires, praying for different things in this world. But that Arjuna, whom Krishna is speaking to, should rise above these things and should try to understand the eternal soul, which is beyond any material quality. So from the very beginning, Lord Krishna declares in the Gita that he's going to be talking about things that are beyond ordinary material affairs and even ordinary piety. There are many, many statements in the Gita where Krishna, Lord Krishna, of course, those who believe the work, where Lord Krishna states that one has to go beyond piety and impiety, between even sin and piety as ordinarily understood, and come to the point of the eternal soul and the eternal God. the notion of a personal God, by the way, I think I should also mention, is not something really introduced by the Gita, even in the Upanishads, which Dr. Narayan mentioned, these earlier theological works. There are statements talking about a personal God, talking about, for example, revelation of a personal God, that God is an individual being among many eternal beings. And even in one of the oldest Upanishads, the Isopanishad, which is the only Upanishad directly attached to a Veda, which are the oldest genre of literature, you find a prayer by the devotee to God to remove his effulgent covering so that the devotee can see the face, mukham in Sanskrit, the face of the Lord. So the Gita certainly crystallizes and brings out all these points in a much more explicit and in a way which is much more practical for devotion, practical devotion to God. But ultimately, the purpose of the Gita, I think, the very word Bhagavad Gita, the word Bhagavad means God. And so the very title means the song of God. And at the end of the Gita, when Krishna asks Arjuna, did you understand what I've told you? Arjuna said yes, and he says, now I'm prepared to do whatever you say. So this surrender to God, this submission to a supreme personal God, is ultimately the point. It was the test of whether Arjuna understood the message or not, and Arjuna had to fight, not ultimately for a political or social purpose, but as an act of obedience to God, the ultimate result being, as explicitly stated throughout the Gita, that Arjuna would transcend birth and death, ordinary material conditions, and go to the eternal kingdom of God. So I just wanted to throw that in. And as far as literature, what can I say? It's very beautiful. I personally am sort of a Sanskritist at heart, and I sort of read the Gita all the time in Sanskrit. It's a very beautiful work. The composition is excellent. But I don't think that for most people in India or most people anywhere that read the Gita, they can really separate the beauty of the composition from the profound spiritual message which has moved people for so long.
I agree. This is it's a holistic appeal that most Hindus get from the Bhagavad Gita. It's emotional and spiritual. The beauty of the poetry is something that is intrinsically associated with us since childhood. We hear some of the verses at very important, crucial points of our lives, at deaths, at funerals, verses which celebrate the immortality of the human soul. When you hear these verses at such emotional points of your life, they stick with you, and the cadences, the rhythm, the beauty of the words are very closely associated with the most memorable times of our growing up. I would also say, however, that for many people, even if they don't understand the meaning, remember again, this work is in Sanskrit. Even if they don't understand the meaning of the Gita, the sound itself, the physical beauty of it, is overwhelming.
Can we hear some of that?
Shall I do it?
Well, I'd like to hear from both of you during the course of the program. Pick a favorite passage.
Okay, this one is known by Hindus all over India, and it's a simple verse. It's chapter 4, verse 8, which explains the nature of incarnation, why Krishna comes down over and over again to earth. I'll also do a short verse from chapter 18, verse 66, which is considered to be the quintessential teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 4, verse 8, Paritranaya sadunam vinashaya cha dushkritam dharma samsthapanathaya sambhavami yuge yuge. And it translates, for the protection of the good, for the destruction of the wicked, and for the establishment of dharma, of righteousness, I come into being age after age. And in chapter 18, the last chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, we have what is called the Charama Shloka, or the last words, the last verse of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, technically, this is not really the last ultimate verse, but it's considered to be the most important. And it goes, Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mamekam Sharanam Vraja Aham Tva Sarva Papebhyo Moksha Ishyami Mashuchaha. Most commentators have taken this last verse to be a kind of general amnesty statement in which Krishna says, discarding all dharmas, take refuge in me alone. I shall save you from all sin. Do not be afraid. Do not fear. And this last verse has been commented upon by generations of Hindus. Howard, would you like to recite something?
Well, I don't think I can do it quite as well as you, but I can. Sure, I could. In fact, I could just take up where you left off, chapter 4, text 9, where Krishna says, Janma karma chame divyam evang jyoveti tatvata tyaktva dehang punar janma naiti mam eti soarjuna. Which means, one who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in this material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna.
Professor Narayanan, if we were to hear this in a common Indian setting, would it be chanted the way Hebrew scripture might, sung like a psalm like ayats from the Quran? What setting would it be in?
You would have both recitation depending on the setting of the prayer itself. But recently, many singers have set it to ragas, a particular mode of music, and this has been the most popular form of dissemination in the last 15 or 20 years. In many parts of India, it's recited in a simple, straightforward way and then commented upon in either the vernacular language or English.
Vasudha Narayanan joins us from Gainesville, Florida, member station WUFT. She's a Gibson professor in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Florida and the author and editor of 5 books on religion in South Asia and Hinduism in America. Howard Resnick joins us from Berkeley, California, KPFA, professor of Indian Studies at Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley and the author of 10 volumes of translation and commentary on the Bhagavata Purana. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll stop first in Norristown. Is that New Jersey, Ray?
No, that's outside Philadelphia.
Ah, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ray. A great show. I've been dying for years to ask somebody this question. Many years ago, I read a paperback copy of the Bhagavad Gita, and I read it straight through in one sitting. And it was one of the most moving experiences I've ever had. And I don't think it was only the beauty of the poetry. I think, you know, I've tried to explain this to friends. I'm not a fanatic with any religion or anything. I think that my question really is it the function of the translator and how the translation in English touches the soul of what the text is trying to say? Or is it what the person who is reading it brings to it? That creates, it was a moment that I call transcendent, or a moment that everything is a sense of wholeness or completion. And much religious literature proposes to do that kind of thing. But I haven't read anything like it. And the translation I read was by Juan Mascaro. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Ray, thanks for your call.
Right.
I think Mascaro's translation is one of the best and one of the most popular in the earlier times. I think both parts of the question are very important. What the translator tries to do in terms of bringing out the very spirit of the Bhagavad Gita and the projection of the reader or the hearer. In India, this is an oral experience usually, not a visual one, to the whole text is very important. In Sanskrit texts, in drama, there's a very well ordered system of aesthetics about what the text says, what the audience is to derive from it, and the meeting of the two, the synergistic effect of the two. And I think both parts of this would be very important.
I would agree, if I can say something here. In a sense, we have an advantage with the Gita in the sense that the first two people, one person speaking, another person hearing, the first speaker is Krishna, the first hearer is Arjuna. So we have an example of how to hear the text. And, of course, now we can hear the text. But Krishna, according to the tradition, is speaking as God, as the Supreme. And Arjuna, according to Krishna, could understand the text because he was devoted to Krishna. So I think it's a question of a potent seed in a fertile field, and then you get production. The speaker has to have a particular qualification, a particular sympathy. The listener, I think, has to have also a certain openness, a certain willingness to understand, and then the communication takes place. So there's a lot of discussion in the Gita itself about what the qualifications are, what the conditions are for a successful transmission of the knowledge. I'd like to congratulate that person who called in on apparently being a qualified listener of the Gita.
Well, the question and answer form is used in many religions, and I think used to terrific effect here, the sort of lengthy dialogue of questions and answers that helps people understand, get down to the real roots of something.
Yes, in fact, in most of the popular scriptures in India, you'll find that the teaching is framed, so to speak, in a series of conversations. There will always be a speaker, and then someone is listening and asking questions, and they're discussing. And oftentimes the speaker will say, well, actually, my teacher once had a discussion about this. And you'll go back in time to another setting, and then you may go back to still an earlier setting. So virtually all the teaching is framed in these dialogue format.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. My guests are Vasudha Narayanan and Howard Resnick. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll take more of your calls. To contact us here at Talk of the Nation, you can send email to totn@npr.org or regular mail. The address, Talk of the Nation Letters, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20001. 33 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for Talk of the Nation comes from this and other NPR member stations and NPR. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Education Association, preparing America's students to meet the challenges of the 21st century, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Ray Suarez. At a time when affirmative action seems to be getting only negative press, it appears to be working in one place, the military. What's the military doing to successfully recruit and integrate minorities, and why are universities and corporations still struggling with this same dilemma? Can we learn anything about racial integration the Army way? Later on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. Today we're talking about the Hindu text, the Bhagavad Gita. This is the first week in a series of five programs looking at some of the world's great sacred texts. My guests are Vasudha Narayanan, a Gibson professor in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Florida in Gainesville, and Howard Resnick, a professor of Indian Studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. If you want to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. Manu is in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Ray. I was raised here in the United States as a Hindu, and I'm interested to hear how your guests feel about Hinduism as a philosophical way of living life in today's society, because that's the way my parents raised me, is that rather than having hard and fast canons of behavior, it's more of a flexible religion that allows you to grow in society.
I think the individual traditions within the many Hindu faiths are fairly rigid. It's not as flexible as we have made it out to be in the 19th and 20th centuries. However, like all other religions, this has been an evolving faith, and we have made it a very flexible, quote-unquote, the word tolerance is frequently heard within the Hindu tradition. But I'd like to stress something which Howard had mentioned earlier, that this is ultimately a transcendent work. And in that sense, there's a certain sense of timelessness about the Bhagavad Gita, a sense of being adaptable to any place, any surroundings. For instance, the main message of one of the main messages of the Bhagavad Gita is to do whatever one deems to be one's duty or dharma, and act as fully as one can, as righteously as one can, but without thinking about the reward. In other words, don't be attached to whatever grade you can get or whatever blue ribbon you can win, or without fear of punishment. Do it for the sake of the world order. The word used in the Bhagavad Gita is lokasamgraha, for world order, maintaining the world, for world peace, and surrendering your action to Krishna himself. In this sense, there is a sense of timelessness about the Bhagavad Gita in doing whatever we can, be engaged in duty, don't renounce life, but be actively involved with a sense of inner renunciation. I keep remembering Max Weber's words here about the Puritans who, quote-unquote, soberly produced children. In other words, do whatever you have to do, but do it with an inner sense of renunciation. And in this sense, I think one can adapt the Bhagavad Gita or see its relevance in any part of the world.
If I could take up from there, as Dr. Narayan has very correctly stated, the Gita does teach that one should do one's duty according to one's nature. At the same time, one should give up the fruit of the work, not selfishly covet the fruit of the work. Then in the Gita, Krishna states repeatedly that actually the fruit should ultimately, if possible, be given to God. And this is called yajna, or sacrifice, the act of working but offering the fruit in devotion as a loving offering to God. Furthermore, if I could say to the caller here, there's a very common word in India from Sanskrit, which is sadhana. Sadhana means practice or the means of achieving one's goal. And so, as Dr. Narayan has stated, in every tradition, you'll find a concept of a spiritual practice. For example, the Gita teaches we are not ultimately the physical body, we're the eternal soul within the body. We should be detached from the body. We should rise above it. We should learn devotion. And yet there's a process, a practice, an exercise, which actually brings us to the state of consciousness. Reading the Gita itself, as Ray has been sort of asking about, reading the Gita itself, hearing it, speaking it, is one of the main processes. And so I think it's nice that for the parents to give that kind of freedom and that type of sense to the child, that one can grow and one can ultimately be spiritual in this world according to one's understanding. But the philosophy is something to be practiced. It's not philosophy in isolation, but an understanding of a higher truth, which is to be achieved by a disciplined practice.
Manu, it would seem that a lot of things that are sitting there in Bhagavad Gita to be read would be slightly out of tune with American society. The ideas of sacrifice, the distinction between spirit and body, and what it has to say about material gains and those sorts of things.
Well, I'm not sure if I represent traditional American society, given the fact that I'm the product of parochial school education through high school and elementary school and everything. From my perspective, my Hindu faith and religion at home worked very well with my Jesuit school upbringing, in the sense that the sense of sacrifice was something that was taught to us, whether the kid sitting next to me was Catholic, Jewish, or Muslim, or Hindu. And that, I think, pervades throughout the world's greatest religions, which you're hitting on through these programs.
Manu, thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks, Ray.
Could I say something about that? I agree with Manu that I think the spirit of sacrifice is something we're taught since we're kids. I mean, when we were kids, we were taught that some Americans sacrificed their lives so that we could be free. There's all this modern discussion about values, the idea that we shouldn't just be selfish. We should try to work for some higher cause. And ultimately, it's not too foreign from our own best culture in the West that the ultimate cause is to do something for God in the service of others. Also, as far as not being the body, I think implicit in a lot of the ethical positions which are so prominent in America today, for example, don't judge people by their body. You know, look like you're going to have in the second part of your show something about the Army's model for integration. I mean, after all, if we are the body, then if your body's better than my body, then you know, that's the end of it. But there's a sense in America, in our culture, that don't just look at someone's body. Look at the person inside. And so, again, I think we're not talking about things which are so foreign to us if we think about it a little more deeply.
I think Manu's parents are probably fairly typical of many South Asian parents in this country, Hindu parents, who try to stress the relevance of the Bhagavad Gita to everyday life and give a grounding to children. The Bhagavad Gita, after all, tries to play between two kinds of struggle. The external struggle, which is the real battle going on, the blood and gore. And this conversation takes place right on the eve, or I should say moments before the big battle is about to begin, between the two major armies facing each other in the Mahabharata. And at that point, at this very physical battle, Arjuna wonders whether he should do what he is supposed to be doing. And that's a dilemma that many, many of us face, not the exact war situation, but we're frequently caught in situations where we wonder, hey, is this the best thing for me to do? Who says this is right? Or if I say it's righteousness, who defines righteousness, and so on? And the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita in particular juxtaposes this external struggle with internal struggle, the struggle of duty, dharma, righteousness. And the two battlegrounds, the external battles of the world, the internal battles within us, are seen to merge at some points. And this is the kind of relevance that many parents stress to their children here.
Let's go next to Fairfield, Iowa. Dr. Rector, welcome to the program.
Hello. And it's a pleasure to be on your program. I listen to it regularly.
Thanks.
And I'm thrilled to be talking about the Bhagavad Gita. I'm a professor of Vedic psychology at Maharishi University of Management, and we use the Bhagavad Gita as the textbook for Vedic psychology. And we've been teaching students from every country around the world, and they're just absolutely thrilled with the knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita that we find. And what we do is we go systematically through the verses in the Gita and find all of the answers. Then chapter 1, Arjuna discusses all the problems that a person could find and in life. And in chapter 2, that we find first in the Sankhya section of the Bhagavad Gita, the understanding of perishable and imperishable phases of life, understanding about dharma, what a person's supposed to do in life, understanding of relationship with others and the results of actions. And also we find in verse 245 where it says, Nistragunyo Bhav Arjuna, which is be without the three gunas, is actually the instruction of how to transcend. And then throughout the Gita, then you find that the knowledge of the growth of consciousness comes, practical knowledge with Arjuna asking questions, and then the knowledge of the growth of consciousness, the structure of the universe, the values of right and wrong, descriptions of all types of people. Everything that you could want to know about psychology we find in the Bhagavad Gita, and we find it's the most successful tool for teaching psychology.
Well, Dr. Rector, do you think that it gives you a worldview once you internalize these ideas, that it gives you a different way of seeing than other people you're stuck in traffic with in Fairfield? Well, probably isn't much traffic in Fairfield, so maybe I shouldn't put it that way. But.
Right, rush minute in Fairfield where everybody rushes to the dome to do their transcendental meditation together. Otherwise, no traffic jams. But what we find is that the students will come in and they may not have known anything, say, about the fact that the soul is eternal or the fact that that there is life after death, or the fact that what their dharma is, how to find out what they should be doing in life. And it just absolutely transforms them. It gives them a whole broadness of the knowledge of life and what to do, what to say, and then actually how to get there by transcending. And the experience is universal. Last term I had a class with people from 8 different countries, and they're just completely thrilled. Every single one of them gets a tremendous value of what is the structure of life, what is the depth of knowledge. And I think the Bhagavad Gita is the best tool for teaching this.
Well, I'm glad you called today because it gives us an idea that this is a living, breathing text in the United States. Thanks a lot for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Vutsul is with us now from Charlotte, North Carolina. Vutsul, welcome.
Yeah, hi. My name is Vutsul, and Ray, thank you for taking my call. First of all, Professor Resnick, thank you very much for pronouncing the word urgent correctly. I have very serious feelings about the message of Bhagavad Gita and also how it is portrayed and how it is pronounced by the so-called experts. You know, all the different callers you had and between the expert that you have on the show, there were some, I think, three different pronunciations of the central character of Bhagavad Gita, which is Arjun. And I heard Professor Narayan call it Arjuna, but I would like to let her know that there is no such word in Sanskrit language as Arjuna. If you go back to the original Sanskrit pronunciation of the word, it is Arjun, and it is a tendency of Indian intellectuals to compulsively put an A behind a lot of words and expressions in the original Sanskrit language, and I just find that trend to be a very disturbing one. And you know, I think one of your earlier callers said that, you know, whether it is the translation or if it is the message itself, and I feel that a translation is important, but the message would tend to get lost if the pronunciation of the original beautiful Sanskrit language is not correct.
Okay, point taken, Vutsul. Thanks a lot for your call. We'll go next to Flagstaff, Arizona. Mary Jane, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm calling because I read the Gita a number of years ago when I was a 19-year-old sophomore in college, and I did not enjoy it. And the reason that I didn't, as I recall, and my memory may be failing me, but that as I recall, I didn't feel very affirmed as a woman because the protagonists were both men. The subject matter was relevant to men. There was some discussion of women, as I recall, and the domestic responsibilities, and it was all in terms of men in their view of women. And as I said, my memory may be wrong about this, but I'd appreciate the response of your guests to my recollections.
Professor Narayan
first.
I think your caller is quite correct in some levels. It is a very patriarchal text. Remember, it's a Sanskrit text. It was written, put into the Mahabharata, possibly by the so-called higher caste males and so on. There is a particular verse, chapter 9, verse 32, which I'd like to draw your attention to. And it very briefly, it goes like this. Krishna says, for those who take refuge in me, Arjuna, though they are lowly born women, Vaishyas would be merchants, producers, and so on. For those who are lowly born, as well as the Shudras, the servants, they also attain to the highest goal. So, in a sense, the Bhagavad Gita is being liberal, it's trying to be inclusive, it's trying to include everyone, it's really trying hard. But you can't get away from statements like that even the lowly born, like women and the lower, so-called lower caste, attain the highest goal, supposedly, by bhakti to Krishna. So it does deal with mainly male characters and so on. However, over the centuries, I think, because of devotion, the element of devotion, which is stressed so much in the Bhagavad Gita, this has become a text for all human beings in India. I must say, though, that the kind of devotion that is portrayed in the Bhagavad Gita is somewhat more stiff, I should say, less colorful, less intimate than the kinds of devotion expressed by, say, women poets of South India addressed to Krishna. The devotional poems in South India tease Krishna. They're intimate with him. They play with him. They see him in his role as a lover, as a friend. not as the warrior, not as the counsel, not as the minister. And therefore, they tease him. Whereas in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says very clearly, I come down to earth again and again. I incarnate myself again and again to protect Dharma, to upgrade righteousness. In South India, in the devotional poems, the women say, "Oh Krishna, you know no Dharma. You're so playful. You're playing fast and loose with us girls out here." And they address him as Krishna, who knows no Dharma. In fact, it's a kind of playful mood in the poetry itself. So that the devotional poetry in South India, I would say, and in many parts of India, is more intimate, more, if I could use the word, feminine in some ways. I hate to use the word without qualifications. But in some levels, I would like to agree with your caller from Flagstaff.
Vasudha Narayanan joins us from Gainesville, Florida. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Howard Resnick, a comment on the gender economics of the Bhagavad Gita?
Yes, as a suspect male. First of all, in the verse which Dr. Narayan quoted, which I'm aware of and I have here before me, the exact word for low birth in Sanskrit is papa yonaya. Yonaya refers to birth. Papa, generally in the context of Gita-type Sanskrit, means sin or sinful birth. And so according to my understanding of the Sanskrit here in the text, I don't think we're compelled to say that women are being described as being of sinful birth. In fact, if you look at the Mahabharata, there are many great women like Kunti, like Draupadi, like Gandhari, who in no way whatsoever could ever be called sinful of sinful birth. It's impossible. So I personally don't think that Krishna is saying here that women are of sinful birth or merchants are of sinful birth. A merchant birth is not a sinful birth. I think you can easily read the text. Krishna is saying, whoever may be of sinful birth, and tata, which means also, or the women, the merchants. Krishna is talking about people, as Dr. Narayan said, who traditionally were excluded and saying they are not excluded. They are also, they can get the same perfection. So I don't think Krishna is engaged in woman bashing here. One last point regarding the intimacy of devotion as opposed to the Gita, it's understood within the tradition that the Gita is, so to speak, the ABC of devotion. Although it's spoken by Krishna, who's held to be God, still Krishna is introducing very, very simple basic things, that you're not your body, you're an eternal soul, and that you have to work without detachment. I would say that those wonderful South Indian ladies who have an intimate relation with Krishna already know these things. They've known these things since they were children. And so in the bhakti tradition, the tradition of devotion, once you understand the basics, then you move on to the intimacy with God. If one attempts to be intimate with God before understanding that there is a soul, one tends to take God in an anthropomorphic or material way, and that leads to all kinds of historical aberrations, which we don't have time for here. Well, so I think it's not... Excuse me.
I just wanted to say goodbye to Mary Jane in Flagstaff and thank her for her call. I didn't want to end, we're almost done for the hour, but I didn't want to let it pass without noting a couple of verses that caught my eye. He who sees me everywhere and sees all things in me, I am not lost to him and he is not lost to me. You shall certainly be liberated from the bonds of action which produce good and evil fruits, liberated with your mind disciplined by the yoga of renunciation. You shall come to me. I am the origin of all. All proceeds from me. Thinking thus, the intelligent ones worship me. Time and time again, when I was reading this particular translation, I kept thinking of gospel passages, which are very, very similar. I am the way. The very self-conscious statements that Jesus makes in the gospels about who I am and who people understand me to be. And I think they're dated by Western scholars as being from the same centuries, Gospels and these parts of the Bhagavad Gita.
And the poetry, the verses that you have quoted are some of the most beautiful ones in the Bhagavad Gita itself. And yes, they do have this very loving kind of invitation, opening it up, saying anyone who sees the divine in anything in the universe just really comes to me ultimately.
Howard Resnick?
Yes, Ray.
Those parallels, have they caught the eye of Western scholars for a long time?
Very much. Well, yes. If I could just mention that in the Gita class, which I'm currently teaching here in Berkeley, some of the students who come from a Christian background, in fact, our divinity students, are kind of astonished by these same parallels that you just brought out. There's one great Vaishnav or worshiper of Krishna Vishnu named Ramanuja, who lived about 800, 900 years ago. And he was always a very important contact point between Christian theologians and this Krishna tradition. In fact, Ramanuja has his own commentary on the Gita. So yes, Christians did see in this type of devotion, especially toward Krishna and so on, a real contact point and a point of comparison. The great German Christian theologian Rudolf Otto said that of all the Indian spiritual traditions, it was this Vaishnava or devotional tradition which really offered the greatest parallels to Christianity.
Thanks. And there's also a course, I think, being taught in Harvard right now called Avatar and Incarnation, which brings out the parallels between the incarnational theories and different religions.
I want to thank everyone who called and joined us this hour, and thank my guest, Vasudha Narayanan. A pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Howard Resnick, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Ray.
Howard Resnick is a professor of Indian Studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. He joined us from station KPFA in Berkeley. Vasudha Narayanan is a Gibson professor in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Florida in Gainesville. She joined us from member station WUFT in Gainesville.